Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to Teología Sin Vergüenza, queer and feminist theology from Latin America and its diaspora to get those spiritual justice juices flowing. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. You may not have heard from a lot of folks who live shamelessly as both queer, trans, feministas, and people of faith, but you're about to. Even if you don't know it, we are everywhere. We do our work in the academy, in the church, in our homes, and on the streets. We fight for our communities and for our own lives. We are not macho, but we are many. We're irreverent queer feminists who are shamelessly faithful, and we're faithful theologians who are shamelessly activistas. We are shamelessly las sinvergüenzas. We pluck the ripest fruit from the Bible to make juicy queer feminist Latina theology that refreshes your spirit and quenches your thirst for liberation. In this episode, you'll find delicious decolonial theology for the real world right now. So get your cup of coffee, pull up a chair, because you belong here. Now, let's get down to pleasure. Hey there, welcome to this week's episode of Teología Sin Vergüenza. Today I get to talk with Carla Perez, who is a licensed mental health therapist currently living near Phoenix, Arizona, with her 18-year-old son and her two small dogs. With over 20 years organizing experience in social justice and community wellness, they are passionate about the intersection of mental health and justice making. 14 years ago, she co-founded Ministerio Latino, a ministry and community space for migrants and LGBTQIA+ folks to express their faith and spirituality and to create support systems of accompaniment in Oakland, California. Hi, Carla. Welcome to Teología Sin Vergüenza. I'm so excited to see you.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here and see you as well.
I can't wait. I'm just going to jump right in. I would love for you to start. We always start with the same question, which is if you identify as a sinvergüenza, why or why not? And I think in this context, since we're speaking in English, for folks who might not have access to Spanish, sinvergüenza might be a new term. So maybe you could tell us a little bit for you. What does sinvergüenza mean? Like, do you have experience of that growing up or in your culture, like in your family, anything like that? And just tell us like a little bit about yourself. Like, tell us anything you want, really.
Okay, awesome. I definitely do identify as a sinvergüenza for sure.
Yes.
Feels great saying it out loud.
That's right. It takes us sometimes a long time to get here, doesn't it?
It does. Definitely. Particularly for me, I think it took me a while as well for a lot of reasons. But I think with sinvergüenza, what it means to me is, someone that kind of walks to their own beat of their drum and don't necessarily they don't necessarily follow scripts, guidelines, particular expectations from society, their culture,
rules,
families, rules, all of these things, like all the very very descriptive or even boxed in categories that oftentimes I think society tries to place on individuals, especially folks that are either queer, like myself, women, femmes, folks that are non-binary, again, mm-hmm. like myself, don't fit into mm-hmm. these boxes. And so it's a bigger context or praxis, if you will. But I feel that it took a while to get to this place, to feel free enough to be able to claim that as part of my identity. Yes. And just it's like a lifestyle, if you will.
I love that. Somebody who walks or dances to their own drum mm-hmm. beat or... I think that's part of what's so beautiful about our community also, and like the ways that there's like so many different sub-identities within our identities and different mm-hmm. communities, because there just is it feels sometimes like there's a whole alphabet of letters, and that shows me that there are so many different ways to be that we as a whole group of people have just kind of been like, we just refuse to mm-hmm. be stuck in those tiny little boxes, because even new names aren't like complete without the fullness of who we are. And so just yes. hearing and feeling people claim themselves feels like it is shameless, because we are literally taught, almost yeah. all of us, and especially if you grew up in church, like mm-hmm. you were taught you're supposed to be this one way. Yeah. And so I feel really proud of being una sinvergüenza, because it means yes. like not only am I saying like I can't fit into your box, but I'm saying I actually don't want to. I want to be mm-hmm. me.
That's very true.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that process for you.
In a way, you know, to be honest, if I can think back far along, I can think as young as a 6-year-old, you know, where I would see novelas or just like, you know, things that are very part of like the culture, and like, oh, everybody would be like, oh, marriage and I don't know, things like that. And I always felt like, oh, I don't know about that. I don't really know if I want to do that. But it would just be a lot of questions, or me questioning like the identity of how God was supposed to be and he and all of these things that I feel that I just had so many questions. And so I think from a very early age that I can name and say it started from there and it just carried through. And then when I maybe started experimenting or exploring more, where I allowed myself was around college time, where I had the opportunity to be around different people and be around different experiences. And then, you know, becoming a mom at an early age, and that part was still kind of like, okay, so sure, like expectations of what would make my family happy at that time. And I did those things too. And yet yep. within that, I was also like having an internal revolution, you know, internally, where I was like, yes, I'm a mom. And yes, I, you know, present very like heteronormative, but I also feel all of these mm-hmm. things inside. And so I think a lot of the people that I had around me is continue to still have around me that allowed me to be able to ask these questions, explore, not feel ashamed, and question things. And I think also being in doing from a very early age, doing a lot of community work, to be honest, that's where I found my own community as well. Communities, I should say. I think that's where I also found these safe spaces to explore those things.
Well, like the ability to ask questions and be curious feels like such a God-given gift that we get to like be curious and learn. And sometimes it feels like there's a lot of pressure to not ask questions and just go along with what we're taught. And I think it's really brave when we are willing at any age to start listening to our own questions and not just pushing them down of like, well, it must be a lack of faith, or something mm-hmm. must be wrong with me, or I need to try harder.
Yeah.
Because that is what we tell ourselves until sometimes we just can't anymore. But I really am interested for you, like, you were a mom at a young age, and that ability to be a mom, you were like totally completing a like good woman kind of like trope.
Yep.
But you weren't sure that you wanted to be a mom before that happened. Yeah. And so like Tell us a little bit about that experience. I know that you're like the oldest daughter. You have a lot. I think a lot of our folks would understand that experience of being like a Latina who was like the oldest daughter who had lots of expectations for like being the role model.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so how did that work for you, having those expectations, having your own questions, fulfilling some of them, but still having, you know, a whole internal world that had different thoughts? What was that like, and how did that play out for you?
That's a great question, because I think back at times of that time period, and it was extremely hard. It was very difficult because I would oscillate in between from spaces of being like, yes, I have a right, like you said earlier, to ask these questions, like the ability to, the access and ability to be able to ask questions and to, you know, to go internal and explore that internal world. And other times, because of either, you know, pushback from folks or questioning, or people like, you know, questioning my, I felt like my own humanness was questioned at time, or like, what's wrong with you? Or, ¿por qué eres así? ¿Por qué piensas? You know, things like that. Like I, you know, I had only one child, and, you know, now he's 18. But oftentimes when we had him, it was like maybe 6 months after or a year after, I was asked like, oh, el otro, like the next, when's the next baby coming?
Right.
It's like, well, how do you know even if I want another child in the first place? So it was just, it was really difficult, because then I oftentimes felt like I always made a joke actually at that time to my my then partner, and I was always say like, oh, I was born without like a couple chips, and I think they forgot in the factory settings that I didn't come with those like anhelos or like desires to want to do these things. And so there was this like push and pull where I felt like
to have lots of kids in a big family.
Yeah.
Was that the chip that was missing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or like desiring to like follow certain roles as like the wife or the mom, you know, or like the oldest daughter, and like having to follow all the rules and be sometimes the caregiver, the breadwinner. In college, I was in college, and was about to get married, and this is before, like a year before my kid was born. And then my grandmother was dying from cancer, and she had raised me, and it was like this expectation. And I did that from my heart, but it was really difficult. I think back now, I'm like, wow, like to put that pressure on like a 21-year-old to take care of a cancer patient who was my grandmother at the same time and be her main caregiver. And you know, she passed away after 6 months, but it was just a lot to carry. But it was just like the expectation because you're the eldest, you're the oldest kid, and you know, first generation. So like you have to also support your family, your parents, while I'm also a new mom, while also navigating like my own educational journey that I wanted to do as well. And also, you know, my own identity, other parts of my identity as well. So.
And it's like not even sometimes seen as the miracle that it is to be able to juggle those at all. It's just the expectation of like, this is what we have to do. And coming from people who know what it is just to do what you have to do, there isn't sometimes even reflection on like how hard it is. And I wonder if your like now self has like gives that former self like lots of love and compassion and like
100%
you did that thing.
Yeah,
because we have to do it for ourselves sometimes, right?
Yeah, there was no prototype or formula. Like I was it. So I didn't have anyone to lean on or anything. The expectations were for you, baby. Like you got to do that. Like then your sister's here and like she's following your steps. So you got to make sure like you don't mess up and you do these things this way. So it's a lot. Like during that time, I followed a lot of like rules and expectations and that model, immigrant story, right? Like that narrative, I definitely fell into that trope at that time because I didn't want to disappoint a lot of people. I didn't want to disappoint my family.
Yeah.
You know, it was extremely difficult. And I oftentimes, within my own therapy and my shadow work stuff that I've done too, I definitely have allotted time to grieve that version of myself and what I went through, and just give that time frame a compassion and care that, you know, she went through at that time, or, you know, they went through at that time.
That's right. I feel like that grief is real. Like, I think we can hold so many things at the same time if we give ourselves space to, which is like, we can both be proud that we did those things. We can both love our families, and we can grieve what we had to do to get to where we are now at the same time. Like, we can hold all those things together.
Yes, they can coexist.
Well, I'm curious about, right, they can totally coexist. Okay, so I want to hear a little bit more about your queerness and your journey around that, because I first heard of you as the co-founder of Ministerio Latino. So Ministerio Latino, for me, during pandemic, you know, what I know of it, I would love for you to tell more, but what I learned of it was through another sinvergüenza, Reverend Rina Ramos. And during pandemic, everything was locked down. I was like in Appalachia, deep in the woods. And to find this community, like inclusive queer and trans community of people like across the U.S., in Latin America, but folks who had had a lot of experience with immigration, being detained, queerness, transness, and seeing a church community that was committed to not only accompanying but celebrating our community, our LGBTQIA plus and Christian and immigrant community, was so unique that I just look forward to, even though I was literally on the other side of the country, I look forward to that time so much. And that was just a respite for my soul during that time. And that's how I learned about you, because you were the co-founder with Rina Ramos, and she would always talk about you. And I'm curious, because in our first conversation, you said that you were an ally at the time. Is that true, that you were an ally at the time that Ministerio Latino was founded? Will you tell us a little bit more about that ministry and about you at that moment?
You know what? That's like a running joke.
Where were you? What were you doing?
That was like, it's like now a running joke within our own community, like in the folks that were there at that time, because they're like, and you were so married and like so straight.
To a dude. You were married to a dude.
To a straight guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like very accepting, by the way, you know, but like just, like that heteronormative, again, couple. And I was like, yes. At the time, Rina Ramos, Pastora Reverenda Rina Ramos, was doing a lot of community work. I was doing a lot of community work. And then we just, you know, connected at that time and became really fast friends. And she came up with this amazing vision to create a space for LGBTQI plus folks, specifically though for like migrant and you know, the cherry on top, especially for folks that were Spanish speaking too, because it's hard to come by to find a place like that or a space like that. And also that practices their faith. Like, what? What are you talking about?
Literally, so, yes.
Yeah, and it came from this space for her of like her wanting to find something like that. And then I was also, like I would mention earlier, I was going through my own, you know, revolutions internally where I was like, I want to know more. I want to explore more. Like, but is this really, you know, I was just going through that time period. Mm-hmm. And it was beautiful because we just mesh and coalesce really well. I was like the ally at the time. And, you know, I followed because I have so much respect for Rina. I was like, whatever you do, whatever you say, I'm there. Just tell me when to go and what to do. And we did. And it started literally in a living room of a family, a Guatemalan family that had migrated recently at the time. And we went and talked about, you know, our take, our sinvergüenza take of the story of, you know, Christ during Christmas time. And they were just kind of like, whoa, well, because their son identified as gay. And so we were talking to the family. Like, we didn't realize it. Now I think about it, it was like, oh, we were kind of low-key doing family therapy in a way, but also theología, you know. It's just like all the things. And then it evolved from there. And then it kind of started growing from her space from her living room to where, you know, the United Church of Christ adopted Ministerio Latino, where we're part of their ministry. And it's grown for over, I think at this point, it's like 12, 13 years that's been running. And
amazing.
Yeah, it's been an amazing experience, to say the least. Yeah, the work that they've done and we've done. And I say they because now we have like community members that are there. This was in California. I'm now in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So I support in different ways, like from afar. But it's just amazing work that they've done and they continue doing, that we continue doing. Yeah.
I love the story of folks who are allies, because I didn't know, like, literally, I didn't know until the moment that I first kissed a girl that it never occurred to me. It wasn't even on the table as a possibility. And then it just like hit me like a sledgehammer in the face. And I was Doesn't it? Oh my gosh, yes. Here I am. And this is me. But for the folks who are allies who are like, no, I believe, because I was like, I thought it was a sin literally until it happened to me. And then I had a whole like process of trying to figure out what I thought theologically. But for folks who are allies and it's like, you're close, you're so close. And then you just keep getting closer. And then at some point you cross the line. And so I'm curious of like, how was that journey for you? And what, especially like being married to a man and, but you were in like organizing and you were in movement space. So I'm sure there's like a whole consciousness that happens. So tell us a little bit about that journey. Cause I think it's really important for folks to hear like these things happen in our community all the time.
And
it's really important part of the story.
Absolutely. You know, it happened a little bit later. So, you know, I was very heavily involved in Ministerio for a number of years when we started it. And then at the time, my husband and I, we moved to Arizona, which is where we're at now, or, you know, my son and I. And a lot of the things that I gained from Ministerio, the things that I was like beginning to explore more of, really definitely stayed with me. Going back to what we said earlier about my role as an older daughter, I was always just in California. I was always in that time period, just always consumed with supporting, helping, being a provider, a caregiver, all the things, right, that we all do, or, you know, older kiddos do. I didn't really have to do that here in Arizona because we came here, honestly, with no family. There's no family members. So we just took, at the time, my then husband took a role as a union representative here in the regional area in the Southwest. And so I think that space allowed me to be able to finally kind of sit with all of these things and explore more and like think about it. And I had really honest, you know, the thing that I'm very thankful for is that him and I always had a very open conversations and communication. And so I was always very honest and said, you know, I'm having these feelings. I'm finding, you know, women very attractive and I don't know what to do with these things. And meanwhile, I'm talking to, you know, my friends from California still. And the beautiful thing that he, you know, gifted at that time, that relationship was saying, you know what, you should really give yourself the opportunity to explore that. Because what if, you know, what if you are queer, you identify as such, and, you know, you don't want to not give yourself that opportunity to explore that. And so we had an agreement and I had that opportunity to happen, you know, with a friend, unexpected. It was not, it was it, not planned or anything. But it did. And it, to be honest, it like it, you, when you said it hits you like a ton of bricks, it hit me with a ton of bricks because it just confirmed. It confirmed. I was like, I knew it. I knew I was queer. I knew it.
Yes.
All these feelings that I had. And you know, it was amazing. It was really great that I'm very thankful that I was able to experience that. Yeah. Had I not explored that, I just always think like, who would I be still? In what spaces would I still be in? What shadows would I still be in right now at this moment?
We had talked before, and I want to bring it back to this conversation. You had talked about this moment, you know, where your son is 18, my daughter's 15. I only had one also. And I know that like expectation of like, what do you mean you only had one? What happened? Like, there must be something broken or like, you know, but you were talking about rediscovering yourself and the space to like learn more about you. And, you know, I think it's really wonderful and exciting to think about, okay, what's now, what's alive. And we were talking about like gender and binaries and using they and she pronouns and like this queerness and this space. I mean, literally the desert of Arizona has so much space, like yeah. just, it feels cosmically like the sky is bigger there. Sometimes I get really intimidated by that big sky, but yeah. I'm curious, like, what is that? How is it going? Like, what are you doing to rediscover yourself? What mm-hmm. is bubbling up? What makes you feel excited? What have you learned yeah. Now at this age, which feels like a very different rediscovery process for me, at least, than yeah. when I was in my like teens and early 20s?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I feel like I'm still in the thick of it, to be honest. I was just having this conversation yes. yesterday, mm. actually, with some friends about that, and that, you know, it has started with the basics of, oh, okay, now that my son is in the process of, you know, starting college and he's more independent. I mentioned to you that he is autistic and, you know, with lower supports needed, but nevertheless, right, in terms of guiding us a person mm-hmm. in the world, you know, with these different abilities can be really challenging. It just requires a lot more. As my cousin said once, she was like, it's a very complicated maternity when it's like that. And so I have always been all about my kiddo and supporting. And so now that he's 18, he's having his own risk discoveries yeah. and all of that. But in seeing that and his ability of doing that and like sharing that with me, because we have an amazing relationship and very close in communication too, it has given me also permission to again feel like, oh, okay, cool. Mm. I can also do that for myself right now. And it's okay. Like, you're okay. Yes. We're okay. I'm slowly and surely starting to, like I was mentioning in our first conversation, you know, I'm investing in myself in terms of my body and moving in different ways, battling through different autoimmune stuff, you know, conditions that I have and the changes, but also when it comes to like my identity and things like that, I've been really patient with myself and really allowing myself to be in, you know, queer spaces here in Arizona. And that's been amazing. I don't have anything definitive at the moment that I can say like, oh, this, you know, but I can say that I'm already beginning to try different things, whether it's like hobbies, yes. whether it's, you know, queer yeah. spaces or queer spaces that I'm in here as like more of a person that has a 18-year-old and giving myself that permission. Yeah. It's a really beautiful thing. It's like a sense of rediscovery all over again. So I'm yes. excited. I'm very excited to do that.
I love right it. Now. We met for the first time in person last year because you came to Teología Sin Vergüenza's like transnational gathering of queer yes. and feminist theology. And so I think a lot of folks would be interested in like what that experience mm-hmm. was like, especially coming from the U.S. And we particularly included folks in diaspora to be able to come and have that interaction. And I think it's probably a little bit different from you because you're an immigrant yourself. So there was mm-hmm. some folks there who were born mm-hmm. and like first in here in the U.S. who went down to have some of yeah. their first encounters, but you were kind of returning back to Central mm-hmm. America in that, yeah. in that space. But so I'm just curious for you, will you tell us for listeners a little bit about what was the encuentro? What was it mm-hmm. like for you? Was that part of this process of rediscovery yeah. and like giving yourself permission? Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's actually what it was. It was one of my other entry points recently, actually, because my kiddo was still 17 at that time. So I was like, I'm just going to go and do this. And this is an opportunity to be in more of the spaces. And oh my goodness, the fact that it was in Latin America and Mexico, Ciudad de Mexico, even more, like it just made it so much more enriching. But the space was an amazing gathering of folks, especially I met the majority of folks that I was able to talk to were folks from the diaspora for sure, but individuals that are like in the thick of it in Latin America, you know, challenging the status quo, doing this sin vergüencismo out there. It's just always remarkable yes. and admirable to me to see that the theologians, community activists, attorneys, you know, just people that come from different experiences and have the different backgrounds, but are also, there's like a thread that connects, which is around, yes. It's just this bigger like theology or sense of what it means to live fully in your identity and to be in community and share these spaces together. And it was amazing to hear the stories of individuals. I came back and I was definitely invigorated, and I wanted to experience more of those spaces like that, to hear people that are on the ground doing the work and the stories of people like, you know, this lady from Ecuador who is an attorney, and like how she's challenging at the state level, all of these things that are just, it's amazing. It's just incredibly mind blowing. And to be able to share that it felt like a gift, to be honest. Yeah.
Same. I felt like it was such a blessing for me, and I feel so humbled by literally everybody. Yeah. Everybody there had a reason to be there, had a story for why they were invested in queer and feminist theology. Yeah. And I think it matters that those spaces that we get to cross-pollinate, like we had, I think there's this question in my mind that I'd love for you to speak to, which is like, there is this space that exists between where we're from and where we are now. And my question for you is like, as an immigrant, like, you know, do you feel, what is home? Where does home feel like? Is home Nicaragua? Is home California? Is home Arizona? Is some home something else entirely? Like this experience, I think that so many folks have of like, ni de aquí, ni de allá. Like, I'm curious what your experience is with that, if you have that similar feeling, or if you feel like, nope, I am fully U.S. person here in the U.S., like here, and if that feeling of like being from somewhere else ever goes away, or, you know, what's that like?
I have always thought about this. It's very much things that I've written about, and think about oftentimes with folks. And so the short answer is absolutely not. I do not feel like I'm from here, the U.S., you know, not at all. I'm very, very clear from this lens. Like I'm an immigrant, you know, I'm originally from Nicaragua, and those were my ancestors come from the Latin America diaspora, and even further from other parts of the world. But, because we also, like in my own, in Nicaragua, so I have also Caribbean and like Black, Indigenous as well. Mm-hmm. And so I honor that very much so. And so I feel I have always felt this big, big, big connection to a sense of community from back home. And as an immigrant, have always kind of been in the space of, like exactly you said, ni de aquí, ni de allá, not from here, neither from here nor from there. I navigate multiple worlds, two or more worlds, where it's like, yes, Latina, but also sometimes I feel, you know, Caribbean, Indigenous, Black, in terms of like, you know, ethnically where my family comes from. And the languages too, that my mother still speaks Mezquito, which is the traditional Indigenous language in Nicaragua. I have always felt like very much extended, not boxed in one category or anything. So very diasporic in that sense of how I operate or how I move in the world, very much that way. Home feels like the community spaces that I form, to be honest. I have many homes. Yeah, I have many homes, if I can say. Nicaragua feels like home, but also the Bay Area feels like home. And then here in Arizona feels like a part of home as well. Like there's little homes that I've been able to make throughout. Although recently I've been thinking about moving back to California, maybe towards like Southern California, where now my sister and her partner reside. And so to be closer a little bit to family, but that's something that I'm kind of, it's out there. I'm kind of thinking about too, like just because land also is important to me and being around water and come from water people. And so that's been something that has been in my spirit lately, but I feel that that's how I move in the world. It feels like I have many homes, and I find them through the communities that I, that I create, that I'm able to be a part of. And that's, again, it's a blessing to be able to have been able to be spaces. Like Ministerio has been a home for me for many years, right? It still is in many aspects.
It feels like in every piece of your embodiment, you are a multiplicity of things and people and ancestors and all of those things. I think that's so beautiful. I think that's so beautiful. In a world that tries to get us to be so small, your existence, like literally your existence is, and I know you as so much more of a free spirit and so much more expansive. So it's interesting to hear your stories about what it was like to be smaller or more boxed in, because my experience of you is literally the opposite of like a spirit that's just freer. And so I think it's important for us to name that, like, it's a process and we can do that. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about what's going on right now in this country, because you not only are an immigrant yourself, but you are in Arizona, which is a border state, and also part of your work is with our community in mental health. And so I think in this moment, it is incredibly brave for people willing to, like, sin vergüenza, say what they're seeing, what they're experiencing, and being willing to name those things. And so I wonder, like, will you tell us a little bit about your work and what you're finding, how you're feeling yourself, and how you see our community in this moment in Arizona, and what is going on? How would you talk about that, or how would you give name to what's kind of happening in the political targeting and I would say spiritual terrorism that's being waged against our community? Will you tell us a little bit about that and how your entry into that world as a care provider for our people?
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, it's absolutely atrocious what is happening, to say the least. My work as a mental health therapist, I work for a community-based organization that mainly provides services for, you know, Latinx individuals, especially folks that don't have insurance or do have like very minimal insurance or underinsured. And so it does feel like very much being in the thick of things. I have clients that are either thinking of self-deporting or have already self-deported or come from mixed status families. It's been a lot of holding space, especially more recently, of holding space for folks to process their fears, their pain, the instability, or just not knowing what's to come next, especially here in Arizona, where that has been, you know, historically such a decision makers, lawmakers against immigrants and the immigrant community. And so that's kind of the source that I've been providing, right? And also advocacy too. Me as an organization, me as a person too, provide a lot of advocacy work too, whether through legislation, lobbying, and even in the way that we provide direct care, just even thinking about, you know, when patients come in through the doors, where do we put patients? Like, we don't want to put them in the lobby because, you know, if ICE comes in, because they can at times and have done at times, we might have a place where they can go towards the back of our clinic and things like that, where we're really thinking strategically of how to maintain the safety too, not just hold space, which is great, you know, and that's providing a sense of safety, of course, but also just physically. And how does that look like for folks? And then also, like, we're restarting we had a program called the Live Out Loud program, where it is for LGBTQI individuals. And so right now I'm actually working with trying to collaborate or create a relationship with an organization here called Trans Queer Pueblo, and they work with migrant LGBTQI individuals that are either in detention centers or just came out of detention centers or in a process of getting some sort of legal status for themselves. And creating a connection there through those organizations and providing spaces for them. So it's direct care, but it's also advocacy, community organizing work too. And, you know, trying to do the best that I can. There's days that are really heavy, to be honest, as you can imagine. and other days that are really inspiring too, where folks are able to share and say, you know, I'm glad that we can talk about these things, and we can cry or come up with, like, you know, strategies or plans. It's not just therapy for therapy. It's like, okay, so what can we do? How can we support one another? And what are the support systems that we can provide as a community, all of us? Like, we're not just providers. It's like, we're in this as well, you know? So,
yes.
So providing those spaces has been incredibly important, and being connected to, again, community, being rooted, is incredibly important. Yep.
Yeah. And I wonder what you think about God in all of this, like, theologically speaking, as we look at what's around us. And so much for me, I just am like, how can anybody think that anything that's happening right now has anything to do with Christianity? And yet there's still this facade or something. It doesn't quite make sense in my brain. Like, it does not compute, but I still hear people talking about God and the Bible to try to, like, somehow legitimize any of the political terrorism that's happening against our bodies and our spirits. And so if somebody were to say to you, like, where does God fit into all of this? Is God on their side? Or, like, you know, just theologically, when you encounter folks, especially folks who are raised in a really religious background, what are their theological wrestlings or questions? What are you thinking about? Or what would you say to those of us who are asking those kinds of questions?
Yeah, kind of wrestling with those questions too. Absolutely. You know, I think that just from a more, like, political standpoint, like, just, you know, who's from a legislative standpoint running the country currently, they have weaponized, you know, God and religion for sure, which is really unfortunate, because that's not the God that I believe in. Does not move the world in spirit that way. It's really unfortunate of how it's being, like you said, legitimized. There's a disconnect in how that their belief systems and how they implemented versus what I and people in communities that don't believe in that, and is completely the opposite. And the way that it's being used and manipulated, and some, you know, to be honest, in some communities, it's working, unfortunately. It's really working, and they're kind of drinking the Kool-Aid, to say, you know, if you will.
Yep.
And so it's very dangerous, it's very dysfunctional, it's toxic, and clearly we're seeing the tentacles of how things are working in our communities. People will sometimes feel like, well, you know, we must have done something wrong, or, like, things are happening for a reason, or maybe Dios así lo quería, God wanted it that way. And it's like, no. How can we see this from a different angle and perspective, and but also understand, like, the landscape of how things are right now, politically, and how things are, they're by design. It's not that it's, you know, necessarily God. It's like, things are happening for a reason, and we're made to believe that. That's actually one of the reasons why I got into mental health, from the background of being a community organizer, because I felt that, yes, community organizing is crucial, it's important, it's, like, needed always. And at the same time, it sometimes, I think back then especially, it was missing the spiritual component of things, in theology too, where it's like, how do we intersect social justice with spiritual practice too, that believes in coming from that perspective and that background. That's and not getting all preachy or anything, right? But
that's okay. You can get preachy here.
You know, but definitely can't do that with clients, right? Like, there's like a way to, you know, that it can be done, you know, with healthy boundaries and things like that. But providing, at least from the perspective of, like, community mental health, by providing a support system for individuals to understand, like, where does this come from? Like, we need to understand and have, like, that awareness of where is this coming from, and why are we being made to believe these things? Because they're not accurate. They're not true. And again, I keep saying it's by design. Let's be clear on that. And then from there,
it's not even biblical.
It's not even biblical. It doesn't make any biblical sense.
Right. Literally. Yeah. I went into theology for a similar reason because I was doing direct service like for recently arrived immigrants and particularly LGBT immigrants. And there was so much religion behind that was used to like accept suffering and oppression and marginalization and criminalization and all of that stuff that I was like, this is not about God, but also I don't have the receipts to say. They would be like, but the pastor said or the priest said. And so that was a big thing for me around why I wanted to go back to divinity school, because I was like, okay, what does the Bible actually say? What is this God that we've all been given? And, you know, we all have different versions of like whatever our denominations were, but there's some basic fundamental things that I just felt in my spirit were like not right. Like, why would God not want me to love this person that I love so much? Or why would God make people trans if that was somehow bad or they were supposed to fight against it? Like, that I had deep wrestlings with what I had been taught, and I feel like I wanted to know. Like, I was like, I need some answers, God. Either the God that, like, I never had a question of whether God was real, but I did have a question of like whether God was worth following. And I feel like it was social justice and like my activism that gave me the information to be able to have my faith. And so I think part of what we do in Teología Sin Vergüenza is do this mixing of like faith with activism and politics.
Yes.
And a lot of people think those things don't go together because they're like, no, the earthly, worldly stuff, like we're not supposed to do that. We're supposed to be spiritual. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, the reason that I believe in God is because I understand things that are happening around systemic oppression that I don't accidentally blame God for. And it is because of my faith in God that I feel called to do this community work.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's something that a lot of folks either don't like or don't understand. So I'm curious if that's similar for you, because I hear you talking about those things so tight together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I think I mentioned in our interview that I had done community organizing for a while, but then I actually came into community organizing with faith leaders. So it was people organizing communities. And so it was one of the largest faith-based community organizations that exist. And actually they're now international, but that's how I felt for me, that it was like, it incarnated the belief system that I grew up with, which was like, and especially in Nicaragua, like with, you know, liberation of theology, or Teología de Liberación. I'm saying it backwards in Spanish in my head. But that's kind of like the praxis that I had, right? Like, it was like, no, you don't just like believe in God. Like, you practice it. Like, this is what, like, you have to practice it. And so how does that look like in your community? Yes. And so I came with that kind of foundation. And through doing that faith-based community organizing, I found that intersection of those things. And so again, here, I feel like it lacks, especially in Arizona, definitely lacks a lot where, like you said, there's just like a disconnect where it's like, either you're very worldly or spiritual or ethereal in a way sometimes, versus like what's happening in the community, or like letting, oftentimes hear like, just God, you know, take care of it. He'll handle it. And it's like, no, but we're here. We're here.
And right. If we're God made us. God,
and if we're people of God, are we not people of God? And so like through God and like spirit that moves through us, we can't make these things happen in our communities too. Like, is that like not part of our responsibilities or the teachings that Jesus had, you know? So it's like really a lot of discernment and like peeling back on things that is in the Bible, but oftentimes it has the way that it's been interpreted, you know, for convenience and may upholding, you know, systemic oppression, of course, that's been, you know, taken out of context. So it's all of those things for me as a individual here, and just in general, always and for sure always talk about these things and how they all connect, right? And how does that look like for on a practical level? Because I'm always about like the tangibles. Like, how does that look like tangible? Like, how do we live in this sense of if like our theology or our practice is this way, how does that look like on a day to day? That's kind of where I'm at.
Mm-hmm. I think there's so much to learn those of us who are in movements in the U.S. from so much of what's been happening both politically and theologically for generations in Latin America. And part of the hope for Teología Sin Vergüenza is to do some more of that cross-pollination because of either the language gap or access to each other's media or things like that. Like in the U.S., we generally have a scope of only things that are happening in the U.S. And I think immigrant communities more than anybody else has a scope that's farther than just like the borders of the like continental U.S. Yeah. Because we are paying attention to what's happening back home and other places where we feel like we're in community. And I swear when I go outside the U.S., I have conversations with like taxi drivers or like the people at the front desk of a hotel or the waitress at the restaurant. And they can tell us about like they're like, and about that president and about this law. And in the U.S., it's like, I can't even tell you what's happening in Arizona, much less like what's happening in like Guatemala. And so I think there's also something about like you just talked about liberation theology. And I think Latin American liberation theology gets like a short, very quick, at least in theology school, like, and there's this thing and it comes from Latin America and then on to the next theology. And I think it's like, we have the opportunity for folks who have lived that experience, that migrant experience. I think there's a lot to learn, like so much to learn from the strategies and the theological approaches to suffering, to war, to displacement, to empire, to colonization. Like literally, if we can bring it into our knowledge here and do the work of like just opening the blinders just a little bit wider. And so I feel so grateful that you mentioned that and your like understanding of like, this is the theology I brought with me when I came here and that didn't go away just because I moved countries.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's, I always think of that too. And I always make a comment about that, especially when I'm out and I have gone, you know, back to home or Latin America in general. Just, that's a beautiful thing you're saying, that it's very true that you can have conversations with anyone, you know, anyone, and they know exactly what's happening. They have its analysis, right, about what's happening. But I just feel
an opinion,
strong opinions, which is great. You know, we, and we can have dialogue, like actual dialogue and conversations. But it's just everything here in the U.S. is so compartmentalized. I think that's too, again, by design, just to keep those blinders on. So that we don't feel connected as connected to others, especially from the global south, you know. So again, everything is by design, and there's reasons why it's done that way. And like media, you know, print media, social media now, and everything is just, I mean, we all know, you know, how it's run.
We all know.
Yeah,
I think that's so important. I wonder, is there anything else that we haven't talked? I'm going to ask you the final question about ancestors and like that fount. Is there anything else, though, that we haven't covered or haven't talked about that you would like to talk about before we, like, we've already been here almost an hour, if you can imagine. That is wild.
I saw that.
But is there any other topic that you're like, I really want us to talk about this?
I'm just, you know, maybe not so much of a question, but maybe like a comment that I am very excited to see for these next seasons, how it's going to look like, or episodes, how it's going to look like in terms of now having a place for a wider audience that speaks English, and how that's going to look like for the movement of Sin Vergüenza, and how like just larger conversations that I can foresee it expanding even more. So that to me is very exciting. And I wonder how that's going to look like. Just, I wanted to make a comment about that. And that's, that kind of like stayed in the back of my mind. I was like, oh, I wonder how that's going to look like. I'm very excited about it. But yeah.
Is there a conversation that you really hope we have as we, like, as our community expands to include folks that don't have access to Spanish or who speak English? What is that? What are some of those for you? I'm interested in what's juice, what feels juicy there.
I mean, encanta, because I remember how you guys would say, in earlier episodes, like previous years, it was like, oh, la parte jugosa. I was like, yeah.
Yes. Yes. We're translating the like parte jugosa de la Biblia.
We're translating
that as like, we're plucking the ripest fruit from the Bible to make the juiciest queer and feminist theology. So, you know, the things are hard, like that double entendre is hard to translate into English, but we're doing the best we can with our little like crossover understanding. But yes, juicy is an important word in queer and feminist theology.
Yes. Absolutely. I remember in Mexico, we had a whole thing where it's like, yes, jugosa, like the frutas. That was really cool.
Yes. Yes, Ruth.
You know, again, being part of the diaspora, I think maybe that's just because of my own experience. I wish there was an ability to create spaces for folks that are in the diaspora to have larger conversations with folks that are in Latin America, that are there. Conversations about how do we support each other? Obviously, like we also being here have a role. I know like there's different abilities and access to resources and all these things, right? That like, you know, can't assume just because we live here in the US, like we have, but also, yes, there's like more access to things here. And so how can we be more supportive without imposing our own stuff that, you know, from here, I just heard so many different projects and initiatives and things like that that were going on that I remember asking folks like, oh, you know, is there a way that we can support? And not just monetary always, right? Like, yes, monetary is great too, but there's also other ways too, that it's not so, it doesn't feel so always transactional. It feels very intentional and like it builds community. So yeah, maybe that's a question that I always wrestle with. So my background was in international relations, just super quick. And so I guess I always think that way, like a very, very meta level. Yeah. And so I was in my head always about like, how do I, yes, as a Nicaragüense, you know, like viviendo acá, like living here in the US, at some point I want to be able to somehow support some type of work that's already being done in Nicaragua from here. And I was able to do that a couple years ago. And it was a beautiful thing that we did, and those connections. And it was just very intentional, very deep level work that I always think about. I'm like, I really wish like people from the diaspora here in the US were able to have those experiences like that.
Well, I just feel like there's so much, maybe it's like loneliness or heartache or heartbreak. And I think that's both true from being here, but not like every day. I think of most of my growing up life, people would be like, where are you from? Where are you from? And I'm like, I was born in the US. I grew up in the US South. I sound like those people that were asking me that question, but I, from how I looked, was like immediately labeled as like not from here. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's that like, this like el sueño americano, like once you've made it to the north and to the belly of the empire, then you've like made it and you must be rich and everything must be fine and you must have no problems. But on the other side, it's also like the abandonment of home and that like place where our ancestors were buried and where we grew food and our connection to the land. And then again here being like, we're not that not fitting in here. And so I feel like it's part of the colonial project to like try to convince us to assimilate into this white supremacist world that makes us feel even farther from those places that we come from than we actually are. And so that work of trying to like tejer or weave together back that memory, that body memory, that spirit memory and that connection and recognize the access to privilege and power and all the things that we have being up here. It's like, that is very important spiritual work. Like the financial ties, I think, are easier to see and easier to identify and easier to like recognize and see as important. And so many folks and money home and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't see as many people doing that work in the spiritual realm, in the like, what does it mean to be spiritually displaced? Mm-hmm. And in this moment in time where we're being displaced from like immigrant communities are being displaced again within the displacement. Like, it's just one thing after another. And I think that's a particular kind of trauma.
Oh my goodness. Yes. I've had just spoken to this to my prima, who I just, you know, I sponsored her last year from Nicaragua, because at that time Nicaragua had been going through this dictatorship rule to a point where even this government recognized it prior to Trump, of course. The government said, okay, well, these couple countries will allow this amount of slots for folks to be able to come in through a sponsor. And so thankfully I was able to do that with my cousin and her family, and they came here. And so now that, going back to your political question, the political climate of where things are at right now, they're living in this other, their sense of fear again. It's like, wow, you just left a place where it was so oppressive in many ways. And so now you're coming in here again under this rule of what's happening too. So it's like this double oppression that they're experiencing again. That just always stays in my mind, and that thought of spiritual displacement, because it definitely does feel that way. I always talk about feeling, even though I've been here for over 30 plus years, Nicaragua as a home has just always stayed here very much in my spirit and my heart.
Yes.
And
yes.
That spirit will always continue on, and it just feels like a sense of displacement, and it just permanently has stayed with me, and I know it has stayed like that for a lot of people. So this is a really great conversation and question for many of us that are here, and also for folks, you know, back home as well.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about too, because, you know, there's this aspiration for more fill in the blank access to resources, education, more freedom, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And we don't want to mess that up for folks. And also at the same time, there's a lot that is lost in that grieving that you were talking about. We can both, you know, have chosen either economic migration, political migration, forced migration. We can have done that, and at the same time feel the longing and the grief of that other place and people that we were and we came from. And so in that spirit, I'm curious about who are the cloud of witnesses, or who are the ancestors, be they blood, political, cultural, theory, you know, who are those folks close in to you that when you need reminders of who you are and whose you are and what you come from, where do you go for that renewal when you need it to, for those reminders, like who are those folks, or who are those peoples?
It's a beautiful question. Mm. I start oftentimes with my grandmother. I think that my grandmother was, my maternal grandmother was like my first. She is now obviously an ancestor at this point, but provided that sense of like just solidness, deep sense of love for community, and showed it in many in ways. And she was like, you know, this woman that believed in God, of course, like the God that, you know, old school, but nevertheless, like provided that those spaces for folks. And she always had people, we always had people in our homes for multiple ends of times. And I, you know, have grown up and followed very similar practice too, where we've had a lot of folks that have stayed in our homes and things like that. So I always start with her, but I always think about too, just writers that I can think about from Latin America that also provide those spaces. Mm. I think of artists too, Mercedes Sosa, like as an artist, as a singer, who was a person who was exiled for many years too. And she sings of songs that speak to this grief as well, like this love and grief also. I'm like drawing a blank of so many different artists too, but... theologians as
well. But music is important for you.
Yeah. So not directly connected to me, but of just individuals that throughout history, throughout my family, but also throughout history, that have been able to speak to these things in different spaces, whether it's, you know, community activists, Angela Davis, you know, bell hooks, and you know, just different individuals that I can, that I think about, that again in different spaces that provide these conversations that or ask these really important questions that oftentimes they're either ignored or maybe not really thought about or put into writings or songs or things like that.
I love it. Oh, thank you for this time. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being a sinvergüenza. Thank you for sharing your heart with us. It's really, really important that our community know each other. And so I'm just so grateful for your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you as well for the space and for everything that you all do and providing the space and this dialogue and the sinvergüenzismo anthology continues. Thank you
yes,
so much.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for Teología Sin Vergüenza. I'm Reverend Alba Onofrio, but you can call me Reverend Sex. Let us know what resonated for you from today's conversation, and make sure to like, subscribe, and share this episode with someone in your life who might need it. Check out all of our other juicy content on this channel and find us on social media at soulforce.org or Teo Sin Vergüenza in Spanish. Cuídate mucho, and remember, we are las sinvergüenzas. Are you one of us? Uf, sí, 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 sí. Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee. Whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.